Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers, the podcast from Seven Hills, where we hear from inspirational people with a passion to make a difference. My guest today is one of the UK's most dynamic educators with a renowned ability to make sense of the world. Sir Anthony Seldon is a historian, university leader, the honorary historical advisor to No. 10 Downing Street, and the author of more than 40 books. So from someone clearly so busy, you might well be surprised to learn that his top tip for life is simply this: slow down. You will do much more. Anthony, welcome to Changemakers.
Thank you, Michael. Very nice to be on. Well, lockdown has forced all of us, or most of us who are not in emergency jobs like the NHS, to have a different pace in life. And it's always been my suspicion, Michael, that we don't perform as well as we could because there's just too much haste, too much nervous energy. And you can see that, you know, in great golfers, great musicians. There's an incredible economy about what they do. And I think lockdown, I've found it, I think others have found it too, that it's been a reminder that by slowing down the frantic pace, we actually get more done and we do things better and we do things more harmoniously and less egotistically and less abrasively and less muddledly, simply because we're just a bit more considered, a bit more reflective.
And I see that, you know, you're a great practitioner of mindfulness. I mean, I've been in meetings with you where I've seen you meditate before a meeting to actually clear your mind. I mean, in terms of the techniques that you favor to get that kind of clarity, in terms of the things that you would advise others to think about when they think, well, I love that idea in theory, but how do I put it into practice? What's the big takeaway, do you think?
Sorry for the pause, Michael. I was just meditating there. I mean, it's incredibly simple. It isn't complicated. All one is doing is getting back in touch with the rhythm of the body. How many people listening to this have been conscious of their breath since they woke up this morning? And by just getting back in touch with the breath coming in and out, it starts to slow down, well, the breath itself, but also the blood pressure comes down, the heart rate comes down, the urgency, hyperactivity in the brain settles down. And, you know, what could be more simple than just closing one's eyes and inhaling?
Does happiness increase?
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, because it tends to accentuate the mood that you feel. So some people say that it makes them very tired. It doesn't make you tired. It merely makes you aware of how tired you are. Maybe you do need to go to bed earlier. And if you're feeling low, if you're anxious, you will become more aware of that because you're actually suppressing that by your activity. But equally, it's a more healing process to assimilate it rather than to deny it or suppress it. So it might be more uncomfortable in the short term, but it's a more long-term healing.
I mean, how does the modern historian bring that into a view of the world, a study of the world, certainly in terms of today, as opposed to yesterday, in terms of are we a less mindful generation, do you think, or are we getting on top of it?
Unknowable, but the sense is that the more one speeds up, so industrialization in the 19th century, Britain's population grew four times in that century, and life became much more frenetic. People were coming out of the villages, into the towns, into the cities, and life became more frantic. There was much less time to keep in touch with the rhythm of nature. And now with social media, we do know attention spans are declining, Michael. So my sense is we probably are. And when you think about history, well, let's come to the most recent history of all, Theresa May. Had only she just sat down on the 13th of July, 2016, her first day in office, and just breathed and inhaled deeply and just thought, well, what can I achieve? What's my premiership going to be about? Okay, it's going to be about Brexit. Whatever I think about Brexit, how am I going to be able to get that done? I've got to take Parliament with me. How am I going to do that? She would have thought it through logically. Instead, she rushed it in the way that Boris Johnson rushed his way of dealing with coronavirus. He started off by denying it, like Donald Trump, who's still denying it. But then he's embraced perhaps an overly restrictive vision of what needed to be done. So it just means that we're going to be the best version of ourselves. We're going to assimilate. We can't be better than the evidence we have in front of us, but at least we can listen to it more clearly if we're just calmer.
I mean, having spoken to you about May at 10, it strikes me that there is as much a cautionary tale for leaders here as there is a history of a prime minister in terms of actually how important it is to get things right early. I mean, you know, I took out of one of the things we were talking about that, you know, it went wrong within hours almost for her.
It went wrong within hours, Michael. Of course, you could say it went wrong because of the history of what she'd had before. So anyone listening to this, who might be taking over a new job. Actually, your previous job probably isn't a very good guide to the new job. So forget the old job and that mindfulness. We're talking about a lot more than mindfulness in this talk, but just to mention it again, allows you just to drop what has been and to come into the what is now. And had she done that, had she dropped the Home Office, I mean, she tried to be a Home Secretary as Prime Minister and it didn't work. And Gordon Brown tried to be Chancellor of the Exchequer as Home Secretary, and Tony Blair tried to be Labour leader of the opposition, and Boris Johnson is trying to be a campaigning mayor of London rather than being a prime minister. As somebody once said, you campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose. And they're different jobs. Had she just thought, you know, it through basically, and that's true of all of us when we take on new jobs. Don't try and do the old job. Think through what's the art of the possible.
And is it a bit of visioning as well in terms of what you want to do with it? Yeah.
I mean, think on your first day, what are they going to say on my last day? What are they going to say about me in terms of what I've achieved and in the values that I've transacted and who I am as a human being? And if you're firing an arrow pointing a rifle, you know, it's really important to get that right, because the moment you squeeze the trigger, the arrow, the bullet have gone. If you're trying to drive to Edinburgh, work out where Edinburgh is and don't just start sort of vaguely going north, following the stars a bit, or, you know, just to be really precise, you know, when you're starting off, be reflective and then keep reflection going periodically in your time as leader. Are you actually doing the best you can do? Because, you know, interviewing prime ministers all my life, as a historian and other senior people, they all say there wasn't time. And to which the answer is rubbish. There was time. It's simply you didn't make time. And therefore, you know, they finish and they rue that they'll never have that power again, like Theresa May now will spend the next 30 years of her life ruining what she didn't do. If only she'd been just less angry and less reactive, trashing what David Cameron did. Boris Johnson's trashing what Theresa May did.
Listen, you mentioned what is now. I'm just thinking about what is now. I mean, if you think about coronavirus, if you think about Black Lives Matter, if you think about the world economic woes, a lot of people are pulling out certain dates. They're pulling out Spanish flu 1820, the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression 1968, in terms of the civil rights movement. Do you think that kind of, you know, mashup of history in terms of those dates, I mean, do they teach us anything? Are they useful, or are they just being used for other sort of other agendas right now in terms of the debate that you're observing?
Okay, so 2 points there. One is history really matters, and the ignorance of history by people in government and people in business, even of their company, is staggering. History really matters because without a historical understanding, we are ignorant. I mean, we're truly traveling into the future without a light. But then it's important, secondly, just to say that, Michael, every situation is different. So the flu epidemic killed 50 million worldwide, which is, by the way, 100 times more than coronavirus is thought to have killed so far, which is 500,000. You know, everyone is different. And part of what happened, as you know, with the response went wrong here, is that people were expecting a flu-like pandemic, but it wasn't flu. And it's very different, coronavirus to flu. So you both need the understanding of the past, but also need to understand that it's always different, and to understand what that difference is. And 68 race riots, going all the way back to the earlier 60s and Martin Luther King. I mean, there are many similarities, and what can we learn from that? Well, just one thing is that peaceful protest produced extraordinary change. You don't need to have violence. Violence often changes nothing because it produces an equal and opposite reaction against you, whereas a peaceful change doesn't alienate and make people angry and make them want to destroy what you've done.
I mean, these words, these are times of danger and uncertainty, but they are also the most creative of any time in the history of mankind. I mean, that could be straight out of 2020, but that's the Ripples of Hope speech by Robert Kennedy in 1966. I mean, it's extraordinary, the sense of deja vu in world affairs at the moment, don't you think?
So I didn't know that speech, but it's wonderful words. And how tragic that Robert Kennedy died 2 years later. Could have been president rather than Nixon, and the what might have beens. You know, I think that the principles never change. Whatever happens to AI, the essential principles and truths of great morality or great religions do not change and will never change, because they are what the human condition is, as is living in harmony with the planet. And we either do that and we'll all flourish, or we don't do that and we'll all perish. So, when individual human agency comes in, and that combines with the technology and economic and social conditions of the day, then that leads to unique factors that do make the race riots of 2020 different to earlier episodes. Principles don't change.
I mean, it strikes me that there is a question, I suppose, for a historian, which is about how progress and how change happens. I was listening to Sir Richard Lambert give an interview the other day, who said, I mean, and basically his conclusion, he was speaking to Ollie Barrett, a fellow podcaster, and he said that beware those that say this time it will be different. I mean, is that the kind of world-weary view of a historian also? I mean that actually there is a sense that we're stuck in this merry-go-round where actually things don't really change, that actually things seem to settle back into a more predictable pace, or do you think actually that's a misread of history and that actually it's always been about change? I mean, I'm interested in your personal take in terms of where you start on that analysis.
The things that change are the things that don't change. So the fundamental human truths, the love of a mother or father for their child 5,000, 50,000 years ago is the same love and sense to protect and want to nurture. But outer things change. Wars and external shocks are always the big catalyst to change. So the First World War 100 years ago saw enormous change in the understanding of the human mind. Freud had been talking for many years, as had others, Adler. But the understanding of shell shock, the sense that the individual soldier was not being lazy or lacking in courage, that something had happened involuntarily. The changes to medicine more generally, the changes to science, technology, travel, communications that the First World War ushered in were extraordinary. Penicillin and many other changes came out of the Second World War. And so war is a great catalyst to change. But, you know, it's also a reminder, because clearly, and this pandemic is showing us again, that our children are unlikely to have the same standard of living even as their parents. And yet, for many earlier generations, there's always been the assumption that one's own children are going to have a better standard of living. But there's the beginning, I put it no more than that, of a recognition that that doesn't really matter as long as quality of life matters. The 20th century allowed us to become obsessed and think that quantities matter. I have to have a bigger house, a bigger car. A bigger ego than everybody else, a bigger salary, a bigger office. Otherwise, I'm not somehow real or alive, or I'm not worthy of respect or authority. And the realization is that, in fact, you know, going out and for a walk, there was a wonderful talk on Radio 4 by Melvyn Bragg's daughter, who is a vicar, just about the sanctity of being alive and being in the moment of now. Mm. And, you know, when people on their deathbeds look back, they do know, I know people talk about this, but it's really true. And they don't want to think about it. You know, we're uncomfortable when we think about it. It makes us squirm. But it is true, and it is going to happen. And so, you know, to ask the questions now, how, you know, what can I do that really makes my life more valuable? Mm. Who are the friends I really want to see? Who are those I just don't really get very much from anymore? What are the things I can do to junk? So there's a lot also in just slimming down, chucking out in coronavirus and reconnecting with what truly matters.
Mm. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, the world at the moment is facing massive anxiety, socially, economically, on the health front. As a historian, to what degree does optimism or pessimism about the future come into play for you personally? And where are you on either side of that in terms of how you see the future of the human story, I guess?
The winners are the optimists, but they're optimists who are also realists. So whereas pessimists are pretty much all of one kind, and even against the facts, they're still pessimistic. And pessimism drains energy. We all know what it's like to have people in the office, people around us, family, friends who are pessimistic and gloomy. And, you know, you just kind of want to edge away from them and listen to somebody else because their talk is self-referencing and it's negative and, you know, and exhausting. But so is it to be with somebody as a Pollyanna who is groundlessly optimistic. So the whole work of people like Martin Seligman, who have helped champion this understanding of the 21st century is about quality of life rather than just quantity, more, are optimists, but they're grounded optimists, Michael, who say, you know, they find the evidence for being optimistic. And optimistic leaders are optimistic people. They have more friends, they live longer, they're more successful, they do actually earn more money. They just have more fun in life. So to be optimistic, and the interesting thing is we can learn to be optimistic. And however bad our life is, we can always make it better.
So a quick tip on finding optimism for those that might be sat there thinking, I'd love to feel optimistic right now.
Get off your big bum, and if you're listening to this, sitting down, walk around. You know, my
not goal, an instruction to me. Then that's
I'd say that was nothing personal to you. You know, walk around 6,000 paces a day. get the app on your phone or get on your watch or whatever, and always every day do a minimum of 6,000. I at the moment am averaging 13,000 this year. I'm lots of meetings I'm having walking around. You know, it just makes you feel better. And an hour's walking a day will have more effect than antidepressant pills, and it will not fuzz the brain. It will give you greater mental clarity. Just get out there, you know, and if it's raining, put a coat on, put a hat on, and it will make you feel better.
Because, I mean, that was your definition for the new normal that you gave us, which was about living life more fully. I mean, the full life as a thought in terms of it's physical. I guess it's spiritual or certainly mindful. Is there anything else that you would say in terms of that life to live more fully as the new normal?
Well, it's more awake. A lot of us just live in our heads, and we don't really know where we are. We can drive across London or across Glasgow or Helsinki, wherever you're listening to this, and you don't quite know that you did that. Or you travel home, you switch off your computer at your office, whatever you do, and you're suddenly at home. And people can live their life like that. So the journey to live life more fully is to live a life more purposefully, with greater awareness, feeling the feet on the ground, a body that's more active and more engaged, a body more in touch with nature, more in touch with other people, listening more, touching more, more involved with the arts rather than just sitting down and seeing a film, go out and or join an online singing or drama or book group. I mean, life is about engagement. It's not about disengagement.
And just final quick one on your lockdown tracks, Let It Be, the Beatles. So speaking words of wisdom, I mean, beautiful piece of music. What does it sort of hold for you in terms of a memory and I guess a lesson?
Well, the memory was I loved it back in, I can't remember when it came out, 69.
Late 60s, yeah.
I loved it. I don't think I understood it at the time till I did start, you know, rethinking my life. And you know, it's something just about letting it be. If your life is difficult, if our life is like a pond or a puddle, you know, one way to deal with it is to ram a stick in and stir everything up. And another way is just to let things be and just to see things as they truly are without coming in and interfering with things. So just I think it's about a more gentle way of life and it's about being rather than doing. I mean, we are human beings. We're not human doings.
Human beings. And actually, I think you're right. I think there was something wonderfully gentle about that song. And unfortunately, that gentle final thought is indeed all we have time for. And my thanks, therefore, to Sir Anthony Seldon, a historian with a lesson about life. I now know that Back to the Future wasn't just an excellent Michael J. Fox movie. I think that we could take that as the collective wisdom of Anthony there, because I think there have been essential lessons there that as you said, that the history is the light that sort of shines forward in terms of the lessons, in terms of understanding that world of tomorrow and perhaps how we get it right. And that's all we have time for this edition of The Changemakers. Do join me next time.